I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
3 employees and 2 work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
1867 was the year that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle delivered to the general public what would become the most replicated, parodied, pilloried, and metaphorically referenced character in all of English literature. A high-functioning sociopath living in a London flat at 221B Baker Street. A one? Sherlock Holmes. Now, the Holmes canon is perhaps one of the most materialistic and humanistic of literary endeavors. I mean, Holmes is devoid of spirituality and simply makes deductions from the observable world. In fact, Holmes's deductive reasoning, dry rationality, and underlying metaphysical skepticism, and also near sociopathic devotion to contemporary scientific breakthroughs, did little to actually betray Arthur Conan Doyle's own devotion to things like ghosts, contact with the dead, and even a belief in fairies. Well, it's this second obsession that would ultimately destroy a friendship in what would surprise many as a deeply conflicting set of beliefs. What would start out as brief, apologetic debate positions over written correspondence and familial friendly mealtimes would develop into a very bitter and public rivalry with his good friend, none other than Harry Houdini. And all because of one dubiously operated seance. What gave away the game? We'll find out on this episode of Box Number 7. Sherlock Holmes's most famous quote of all time exists in the story called The Sign of the Four, which states, "When you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth." And while on the surface is a very clever and quotable line, it also underscores the quote-unquote rationality of Holmes, thus reducing every conclusion to an equation of intellectual and scientific switches. It is the sheer insulated nature of Holmes's rationality that makes his creator even more interesting. Doyle was an avid spiritualist who routinely attended seances and channelings and believed a direct contact with the afterlife was not only achievable, but for all points and purposes was an actionable commodity. Doyle's everyday life consisted of this fascination, and one wonders why none of that ever leached into the Holmes canon at all. Perhaps it was the genesis of Holmes's character that isolated him, for in fact, Holmes was based upon a real-life person, a physician named Dr. Joseph Bell, who worked at the Royal Infirmary of Edinburgh, and Bell's legendary ability to extrapolate what seemed to be startling conclusions from relatively abstract data brought him a host of admirers, including a young clerk named Arthur Conan Doyle. And by the way, should you find it odd that Holmes was not cast as a physician, you are not alone. And the writers of the television show called House covered that base for you. As for all points and purposes, House is Holmes, to include a sidekick whose name starts with the W. Their addiction to opiates, their amateurish skill on a musical instrument, and their inability to germinate and foment any form of intimate relationship or friendship, not to mention their sociopathic treatment of anyone, their baseline assumption that no one is as smart as they are. Anyway, another reason spiritualism may not have made Holmes' stories is the fact that Doyle was largely a skeptic, at least until he joined the Society for Psychical Research in 1893, and from there began a burgeoning belief in the supernatural. As World War I, or the Great War, as they called it at the time, would take 11 members of Doyle's family, to include his own son, Kingsley, in 1918, the desire to communicate with lost loved ones was at an all-time high, not just by Doyle, but by society at large, and the exploratory nature and tendency in people was running pretty strong. Doyle invited a prominent medium to his home in the hopes of contacting his son, and when Doyle heard what he believed to be his son's voice asking for forgiveness, it was game on for Doyle. Houdini, however, started at a different place and arrived at a different conclusion. His baseline setting was one of possibility and plausibility and gradually closed down almost entirely by the end of his life. His relationship to spirituality started when he lost his brother at age 11 and started attending seances in an attempt to make contact with his sibling. Dark though it may sound, the initial impulse to do such things are at least born of an honest place, otherwise known as a broken heart, and the impenetrable walls that death seems to maintain. Houdini went to Wisconsin to a medium that claimed she would contact Houdini's brother and did indeed produce a voice from the other side. It didn't take long for Houdini to figure out the voice, however, was emanating from a hidden gramophone, or as they say today, a record player from some undisclosed location. Not to be completely discouraged, the issue would arise again 7 years later when Houdini's father would pass away, leaving him responsible in the midst of many siblings for his family's care. Houdini sold a watch to pay for another crack at necromantic contact with his father, and thus the money produced another medium. This time, the supposed voice of his father was too vague, and it was raving about how sweet the afterlife was while offering no counsel for the family's current impoverishment, an unknown factor to the medium. Houdini simply didn't believe a word of it and left with less assumption and assumptive faith in the whole process. In the implementation of his own magic shows, Houdini had no issue of confusing sleight of hand with metaphysical power in his shows because he believed it was possible at the time and saw that there was no abuse in blurring those lines. As he began to see the cruelty and advantage-taking over the grieving by mediums, his mind started to change. In his book that he wrote, The Magician Amongst the Spirits, Houdini confessed to employing the same tactics and even setting up his wife, Bess, to act as a clairvoyant, and he began to draw large distinctions between his presentational career and those of an actual practitioner of something else. Enter Arthur Conan Doyle, seemingly on a mission to convert a high-profile skeptic on the matter. They exchanged correspondence over a period of time. Houdini ultimately agreed to meet with Doyle in 1920. Doyle, already claiming a supernatural victory insofar as a medium had contacted his own son, convinced Houdini to visit the same one himself while he was on a European tour. Again, Houdini's magnanimous nature gave it a go and was, of course, subsequently disappointed as the same generic one-size-fits-all language was employed over the prophetic table. Doyle, by the way, was already embroiled in the midst of a public debate over a separate issue, a set of photographs which came to be known as the Cottingley Fairies. The basic history is this. Two English cousins, Elsie Wright and Frances Griffiths, ages 16 and 9 respectively, produced a series of photographs from their home terrain in Cottingley, England in 1917. It depicted very magical looking photographs depicting tiny fairies who were posing, gallivanting, and interacting with each of the girls. Elsie's father was a photographer and actually developed the photos and began to see the fairies, and he assumed it at first to be a prank. Understanding his daughter's artistic proclivities, he attempted to recreate the scenes at the same places with the same poses from the girls to see if it would happen again. It did not. Elsie's mother, however, thought they were legit. She attended a meeting of the Theosophical Society's lecture on fairies, conveniently happening about the same time, and showed the photos around, where a leading member sent the prints and the glass plate negatives to Harold Snelling, a photography expert who did proclaim them to be legitimate and free of guile. In 1920, Doyle was commissioned to write an article on the fairies for Strand magazine when photographs got his attention. He asked permission to supplement his article with the photographs from the girls, and it was ultimately granted. He offered to pay for them, but the father, thinking that he was going to hand forward progress to the whole issue, and because he was smitten with Doyle as a famous person, would not take any pay for them. Doyle turned around and submitted the photos to Kodak for a second opinion, which was far less conclusive. He also sent them to a physicist, Sir Oliver Lodge, who took a very contrary view. He said the fairies were simply dancers with Parisian hairstyles and just clothing that replicated that you would expect of a dancer that was attempting to cross the line and replicate a fairy. Doyle, however, undeterred, he charged ahead with the article and subsequent publications and subjected himself to a mixed bag of both validation and harsh ridicule. Thus was the starting point for Houdini's reticence to validate any of it. But he listened to Doyle and for 2 years developed a friendship between families who actually vacationed together and managed to find themselves even in Southern California together. In 1922, this would all change. Houdini's mother had passed away in Hungary while he was in America, and the Doyles were in the country as well, and Doyle, so confident in his interactions with the metaphysical, offered this time the services of his own wife, Lady Jean Doyle, to help a grieving Harry contact his mother. Doyle's wife, who was conveniently a medium, was a practitioner of what is called automatic writing. In essence, the medium holds a writing instrument and begins to allow the spirit to take control of their hand and their motor functions. Everything written out is allegedly a direct expression of the departed spirit. Houdini, always wanting to be the nice guy, reluctantly agreed. He attended. Lady Doyle went into the requisite trance. Pounding of the table, physical contortions, and 15 pages of text later, Houdini was staring at his mother's alleged communique from the afterlife. And once again, Houdini saw the usual boilerplate things, motherly tidings of generic nature, expressions of how super duper the afterlife is, and profuse proclamations of how blessed he was to have friends like Arthur Conan Doyle. Houdini also saw something else that clinched it for him. It was fake, but he was too polite to call their hand right then and there, so he politely excused himself and left. And in what was perhaps a case of confirmation bias, Doyle, thinking that he had convinced Harry of its validity, went to the newspapers proclaiming that he had proselytized the world's most famous skeptic into the ranks of supernatural belief. Well, this would not set well for long, and as soon as Harry saw that those headlines, the fallout would destroy their friendship. Houdini himself, no stranger to the press, took to them and unequivocally went on a smackdown of all of this speculation. The bitterness of that would never be repaired. All in all, Houdini simply wanted answers, not deception. He and his wife made a pact that whichever one died first, they would be prepared to be contacted by the other. And if it was legitimate, the medium would speak a series of shorthand codes beginning with the word Rosabel. And when Houdini died, his wife held seances every year for 10 years, waiting for that coded language to come across the Rubicon, to no avail. And ultimately, it was never to be. But what made Houdini so sure about the Doyles' chicanery? What was it that happened that knew that he considered Lady Doyle One to be having her thumb on the supernatural roulette wheel? Well, it wasn't the generic greetings in the automatically written papers, and it wasn't the speed of the delivery. It wasn't that Lady Doyle's extroverted contortions that led up to the writing seemed insincere. You see, Harry Houdini was the son of a Hungarian rabbi. His mother was incapable of communicating in English and only in Yiddish Hebrew. And he had no reason to think that the afterlife made her bilingual. The fact that the letters were written in English was enough to give him pause. But that wasn't all. Houdini's relationship to his mother was a hermetically sealed gift from God. He loved her more than his own life and felt guilty of her passing during his absence, and it was a cumbersome backpack of grief that never left him to his dying day. She loved him fiercely, and she brooked little concern for his career or his assumed stage name, a cognate taken from the last name of famed French magician Jean-Eugène Robert Houdin. A name that belies the only name given to him or ever employed by his mother, Eric Weiss. She would have never, ever called him Harry. Not in this life, and certainly not in the next one. And this is box number 7.